Hi, it's Michael Creamer, and welcome back to the What's Next in Corporate Real Estate podcast. I'm thrilled today to be talking to Michelle Ferguson, who is a founding member of CHIEF, which is a private network built to drive more women into positions of power and keep them there. Before that, she was Senior VP Global Business Services and Senior VP Global Real Estate Strategies and Services at Standard & Poor's McGraw-Hill, which is when we worked together. She is a DE&I advocate and a serial mentor, and that's really what we're going to be talking about today. Additionally, she's currently advising the 9/11 Memorial and Museum on the launch of their diversity initiative. Michelle wrote her first book, which was published in May, called Women Mentoring Women. Michelle, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Michael. Great to reconnect.
Yeah, indeed. And we were chatting when I was in New York last week, and really where I wanted to start, having read your book, was with the Wharton study that you reference. And I was kind of amazed that the statement, it says that people who are mentored are 6 times more likely to be promoted. Can you kind of dig into that a little bit and what the reasons for that are?
Yeah, I was staggered by the 6 times myself. Anecdotally, right, I'm not a research person. I think that people who request a mentor are people who take the initiative for their own advancement and are learners, right? I speak about people with a growth mindset in the book. I think people who look to be mentored are those kind of people, so probably more inclined to be promoted because they're actively doing something to be promoted, and mentoring is one component of that.
And I think if we just go a little bit deeper into that, I get that. But then what is happening in the mentoring process over and above what you just said that helps people?
I think getting an external view that's independent is important. I think mentors will a lot of times encourage their mentees to do things they wouldn't otherwise do on their own. We'll give them a go for it. I mean, particularly, right, there's evidence that men pursue jobs based on potential and women on what they've done, right? So perhaps a mentor helps a mentee see their potential. And then I think the other thing that mentors naturally do is open up networks and make connections, right? And the mentee may be, wherever he or she is, may be limited to, well, you know, I have this linear career path. The mentor may open up the conversation to other alternatives and may also introduce the mentee to people who could open up other career tracks.
Right. Interesting. And I should say, having read the book as a man, I thought it was one fascinating, and certainly I learn a lot from it. So I think anyone can read the book and we'll get something for it. It's not just for women. Although I know that's where the emphasis is. And sort of with that in mind, one of the things you talk about is intersectionality and mentoring. Can you just elaborate on that? Because I think that's a particular area which needs a lot of focus.
Right. It is. And it's in the DEI space, one of the 3 things I spoke about. So intersectionality is when a person is part of 2 underrepresented groups. So the person is a Black woman, the person is Asian with a disability, putting a person in any two groups. And, you know, the evidence is that, you're sort of, you have double the barriers or barriers in your way, right? And so, right, you know, the point of the book was, one of the reasons I did women was underrepresented, not overall, but in senior leadership roles. So in the trying to help people who are disadvantaged in any way, right, the people who are at the intersectionality or right are have even more boundaries than someone who's just one part of one underrepresented group. I think the challenge is that if you are the senior, say, Asian woman in an organization, everybody's going to want a piece of you, right? All the Asian women, the Asians, right? And what what I hear from a lot of mentors who are right at that intersection is it's exhausting, right? And you know, they want to help. They know that there is an advantage, but there's too many people for them to mentor or sponsor or otherwise support. So one of the things I'd encourage mentees is I think, and whether it's intersectionality or anything else, people tend to want a mentor who looks like them or is like them, right? So if I'm a Latino with a disability, I'm looking for another Latino with a disability. If I'm a finance person, I'm looking for another finance person. If I'm in media, I want another person in media. But I encourage mentees to sort of drill down to what they most need. And that may not be someone who looks just like them. So if your challenge is that I want to prepare myself for my next move, well, maybe the person doesn't need to be just like you. Or I'm not great at influencing and negotiating or managing meetings. The person doesn't need to be like you. So I almost encourage mentees to not overtax certain mentors. Partially for their own needs, because think deeply about what you need in a mentor, and that may not be someone just like you.
And would I be right in thinking, I guess I want to talk about two things and sort of one question, but one is the value of in what I call internal, so internal to the organization you work for, mentors and external. And within that, you know, that obviously it widens the net of potential mentors, but also as a mentee, to talk to a mentor, which might be uncomfortable for you because they're not the same as you, I would imagine is maybe a brave move, but one that you probably get a lot, not necessarily more from, but you get a different view from, which is equally important.
Right. I do think so. And I think the other advantage of a mentor who's not in your organization is like complete confidentiality, right? They don't have to worry about juggling their responsibility to you as a mentee and their responsibility to the organization. I think you could be more transparent because your day-to-day career doesn't depend on it. So one of the things, the program at S&P is we would never match somebody with somebody in their organization. And we were big enough, right? 20,000 employees, big enough organization to be able to do that. But we would never match someone with S&P ratings with someone else in S&P ratings, right? And there were mentees who squawked about that, but we just thought that confidentiality was really important. And quite frankly, if they wanted to go find a mentor in S&P ratings, there was nothing to stop them from doing it. We just weren't going to match them.
And when you say we, that was the formal company program that you set up and that was your sort of guidance.
Yep.
Okay, so just before we kind of dig a little deeper, I just want to maybe ask you the difference between, or if there's a difference between mentoring, coaching, and sponsorship within a business, because I do think they're easy to confuse as the mentee, I think, and you know, and also it's a question of time. I mean, how many people do I need in the company helping me when I've got a day job? So can maybe just talk a little bit about the role of a coach versus a mentor and then the sponsorship within a business?
Yeah, coaching tends to be focused on a particular area, right? I need to improve my communication skills, want to get better at marketing, maybe even want to position myself for my next role. You generally pay coaches, right? There are people whose profession is being a coach, right? That is their profession. I've hired coaches at a variety of points in my career, have coaches now. Sponsorship and mentoring is interesting. So a sponsor has to be somebody in your organization, preferably two levels up from you in the organization. And that person is the person who advocates for you when you're not in the room. So when there is a conversation about, we're going to create this position or a position's going to open up, your sponsor is the person who's going to say, you know what, the person you need for that is Michael, right? That's who you need, right? And I think that has to be, there needs to be a formal understanding that that's your relationship. And I think you can't force someone to be a sponsor. you can ask, but I think it's also something where you have to earn the right to have a sponsor. And that's by what you do day in and day out, right?
Right. And I think then the difference that you're saying is, and maybe we use S&P as the example, but there you set up a formal mentoring program. People are asked onto it, apply for it. You wouldn't have a formal sponsorship program. You go find your own sponsor.
Organizations are trying to do that. I think it's really hard to say, Michael, here's this person, you need to advocate for them if for whatever reason you don't feel comfortable doing that, right? And so having a sponsor on paper who doesn't really believe in you is not helpful, I don't think.
So that takes a lot of, I was going to say guts, but I think it does. It takes a lot of guts to approach someone two levels above you and say, you know, this is what I'm looking for, but maybe there's a more subtle way of doing it. I don't know.
Yeah, and I do think, right, it's the kind of thing that if you just you, right, and I've had them, right? If you start just developing those relationships, at some point it could morph into that, right? And again, it's based on, right, what you do day in and day out, right? That they see you're acknowledged for your work, so they're willing to use their political capital,
right?
to advocate for you. And I would 100% say if you can find a sponsor versus a mentor, then find a sponsor. But I think it's harder on both ends. Whereas mentoring, it can be someone inside your organization, someone outside your organization, someone more senior than you, someone less senior than you, someone in your function, someone not in your function. I believe, you know, it's voluntary on both ends. It is, I believe it should be very much goal and professional development oriented. You know, one of the criticisms of mentoring is it's really casual and just like a casual coffee. I guess it should be. I don't think that's really what mentoring is.
Right. No, I think that's a very good point. Some people confuse the occasional conversation with someone in the organization when they want help with a particular problem as sort of mentoring. I mean, it's not really. This is a regular occurrence and where you do talk about the difficult stuff and don't just have a cup of coffee and a chat and say everything's fine. So
or just complain about your company or your boss. And I do think, right, like I think, right, things that get measured get done, right? So if you start out with goals, even if the goals change, and I know I've had mentoring relationships with people that have morphed into friendships, and it was almost in some ways it was difficult because we just liked each other so much and we would sort of make like deals with ourselves. We'd go out to dinner and it's like, we need to spend 45 minutes, like half the dinner, 45 minutes to an hour on the mentoring thing. And then we can talk about Jackie O's dresses after that.
Perfect. The book came out in May and obviously that's, you know, pretty much post COVID. And one of the things that we're now hearing about is the difficulty that, and again, this is back, I think, to intersectionality and to a large degree, but the difficulty that some people are beginning to experience or think they will experience about, I'm not in the office, I'm not being seen, I won't get the promotion, I won't get the pay rise, whatever it happens to be as a result of the pandemic and the new way in which we're all working. So is that, what's your sort of take on mentoring in a, I'm going to call it a post-COVID environment, given that as the backdrop, the fact that we're now hybrid working?
You know, proximity bias is a real thing, right? So whether it's a special project or whatever, right? If the boss walks out of the office, a lot of times the first person he or she sees is the person who's going to get that assignment or just, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And I know that throughout my mentoring career, it was less about what we're dealing with now, but more about people who were physically remote, right? I first met you in London, right? And I had mentees in London and in Spain, and their challenge was, I am out of sight. I fear I'm out of mind. How do I make myself visible if I'm not physically visible, right? And I think we're seeing more of that with COVID. So I do think it's actually a great topic for mentoring on how do you keep yourself visible without being annoying, right? So, right? So bombarding your boss or someone else with texts, right, to make sure they know you're alive and that you're working is, I don't think is the way to do it. I mean, I think it can be as simple as acknowledging it with the boss or whoever it is you want to be visible with and say, what would be the best way, right? So I had one boss, and honestly, we were technically both in New York, but we have both had travel schedules. I was spending a lot of time in another McGraw-Hill facility in New Jersey. And so our agreement was like once a week on Friday, I would send him like a high level, this is what happened this week. Because he counted on me, right? He's like, he pretty much gave me a lot of rope to hang myself. He's like, you're free to make decisions. Like, don't be coming to me because we don't have time and I trust you, right? But I still wanted him to know what I was doing.
Right.
So with Jack and I, that was like a weekly update, right?
So I guess what you're saying is, you know, it's about intentionality. I mean, you know, both the mentoring, but also, you know, you've got to figure out what works well. And that means asking, something as simple as asking your boss. So again, from the book, you reference this McKinsey study, which says things are worse for women, I guess, to be blunt about it, post-COVID. What's going on there?
You know, I think the biggest tug is with working mothers or women who have other family care responsibilities, right? And that can be elder care, and there can be people who are actually dealing with both. And I think, you know, the pandemic, especially the early days, shined the light on that, because like not only did you have childcare issues, but you might have gotten to the point that they at least went to school during the day. So whether you were working home or working in the office, you were free of your, for a little period of time, of your childcare responsibilities. And then early on in the pandemic, like, you just couldn't do it. It's well, though, and you know what? Those of us who had the option of staying home were the lucky ones. I can't imagine what women who had to be out, right? Like, because you couldn't find reasonable child care, right? Like, and if you didn't have family, plus we weren't supposed to be.
No, you weren't allowed to.
Right? We weren't allowed to, right? Yeah. You were, right? So I think it just became unbearable, and women, right, had to drop out of the workforce just because they couldn't do both. And it's been a slow road back, because right, even though most of them are back to school, there's still a lot of COVID protocols that say if like some kid in the class tests positive, then like they're back to remote learning. So there's still that uncertainty, right? You know, and I think, you know, men and women, and maybe women more, just the pandemic just kind of said like what's important, right? You know, and if my family is more important, do I want to be spending an hour, 2 hours a day commuting back and forth? Should I find an option that's closer to home that's completely remote? And is it viable to be remote? So I think it's those really practical things that are tough. And, you know, and I think, again, right, it's illegal in most places to discriminate based on gender, but I can't imagine that in a lot of hiring managers' minds, that like in the back of their mind, is it going to be harder with someone who's a working parent? It probably is.
And if you were the mentor of someone who asked you that, what they should do about that, what's the advice you give them? Sorry, I'm asking you the difficult question. But
yeah, no, I think it does come down to, well, number one, for some people, it's the completely practical, I just have to make the money, right? And for whatever reason, you're a single parent. So that, I think, it stinks that that's the case. But that in some cases, they don't have the option, because they're the sole provider for whatever other reason, including their own mental health, right? might be a reason. And then I think the second one, you know, the more philosophical is, what are your values, right? And of course, that starts with defining what your values are. And is the full-time job outside the home at this point in your life aligned with your values? Or, I mean, there are plenty of women who are opting out, and that's been the case for quite some time, right? That just either for this period of time or personally, I'm going to to drop out of the workforce. And you know, one of the problems with a lot of the data, it's who's like working, getting a paycheck, right? So a lot of the women who are leaving the like technical workforce are doing something on their own, right? And that they don't, that doesn't show up in the data a lot of times, depending on how large whatever they're doing is.
Right. So you, when you say, so you mean setting up their own business, which allows them to work around the things that are important to them.
Right. Or maybe, yeah, you know, provides them some flexibility. Maybe it's not full time, right? So they may not always show up in the data as working.
Right. And I think that's a really interesting point. It's, I mean, for most of us, I'd say that COVID has forced us and or allowed us to reset our priorities, or at least think about them in a way that we probably haven't thought about them before, because we haven't needed to, or have been on the treadmill, or for whatever excuse we all give ourselves when we get up and do the same thing day after day and don't actually stop and say, is this really what I really want to be doing? Is this my purpose? Is this good? And I think, and it's a lovely segue to something I want to talk about to wrap up, which is, you know, the younger people, let's say, just entering the workforce in the first 5 years of their career, you know, having a mentor, I imagine, is as important there as it is at any point in your career. But what I think they probably lack is, well, what should I be looking for? How do I go about this? Maybe they're lucky and their company has a program that Michelle set up, and then they're golden because they get on that. But, you know, let's assume that doesn't exist and their company isn't giving them those tools. How do you think they should think about it?
You know, I think early in your career, a lot of us didn't know what we really wanted to do or what our path was. And even if we did, I think very, like I certainly, you know, never grew up thinking, oh, I want to be a senior vice president of global business services, right? Like that
wouldn't occurred to me. Wouldn't have known what that was.
Right. So I do think that mentors are important at any point in your career. I think, right, so it can be either very specific or very general. So generally, right, you start out your career, you're an individual contributor doing whatever. Right, you're an editor, you're an analyst, you're a marketing coordinator, and you're sort of in your little world taking direction from someone else. So I think it's helpful to find someone, and again, maybe not even necessarily in your industry or your company, who's made the successful leap from entry-level job to one level up, and maybe to the point that they're supervising people. Because I think a lot of times the skill set around supervising people is very different than whatever you're going to have as an individual contributor. And it's certainly nothing you're taught in school, right? how to supervise people, right? And there are people, I'm amazed how far they've gone without having much in the way of people skills. So I think finding someone who's just like one step or two steps ahead of you, just to figure out how to navigate some of the nitty gritty of like just getting ahead in your career, right? Someone in your function who started kind of at the, you know, the same thing as you in an entry-level job in your organization is helpful, because there's some of the just navigating like, well, okay, there's the jobs that get posted and the jobs that don't get posted. How do I start figuring out what those alternatives are? Or if I came out of university with like a liberal arts background or a degree in history, and there isn't a logical, like, what things could be open to me, right? So finding someone who had that similar background that did something, you know, I have a buddy who, like, has a microbiology undergraduate degree and master's, and she does DEI work right now. So at some point, she made that pivot, so, right, how did other people do that? So, and I think equally, early in your career, like, again, to the supervising people, I think that's the big one of the big hurdles, right, when you go from being on your own to supervising others is, right, one of the things that will be, you know, well, you don't have any experience supervising people or developing people, right? That's, they'll, you know, and no matter where you are, right, it's like, well, you can't have this job because you don't have the experience. It's like, well, how do I get the experience if I don't ever get the job? So, you know, one of the things you can also do is mentor others, right? So that you have something where you said, I've got experience supporting the development of another person, right? So whether it's a high school student or a college student or whoever, right? But just so in terms of what's the skills that you're going to need to get you further, I think mentoring is a way sometimes to get them.
I think that's a lovely idea. So, you know, in your early years in a career, you could be mentoring people from the university or your high school, which also allows you to understand what a good mentor should be doing, right? Because you have to sit there and listen and hear. And therefore that, I imagine, helps you when you're the mentee and looking for mentors for yourself. So you're right. There's always someone else you can be helping, whatever point of your career you're at, is what you're saying, which I think is a lovely way of thinking about it. And I imagine maybe just to wrap up, Michelle, I mean, again, with the mentoring for the younger people inside and outside of the business, I mean, you know, you can ask your parents if they know someone. You know, there's lots of avenues to get to these senior people. You might not have the sponsor inside the business that you talked about, but, you know, your uncle who's or your aunt who's in business could be that coach slash, you know, whatever it is.
And often college and university alumni associations provide some form of it, right? And there's somebody that you have an affinity point with, which helps, right?
I guess the answer is you've got, but it's on your shoulders to go find it.
I think early on in your career. Yeah, and honestly, the whole time that we had the program at S&P, we started at a certain level, which is where we were seeing the biggest drop-off in women leaving the organization, and then gradually moved down. We never got to the point that entry-level people were being mentored. It was just like, it was a mathematical problem. There were just too many of them.
So I guess that, and if that's true in a company of that size, you've got to think that, you know, you've got to find it yourself.
Yeah.
Which is a good lesson, a good thing to do, and a good thing to learn about. Michelle, it's been great talking to you. I know we could talk about mentoring for a long time. As I said at the beginning, I certainly learned a lot from reading your book, and I've had various informal and, I guess, formal mentors. It's available to buy on Amazon. You can download it, as I did as well, which is great. I would recommend everyone takes a look at it. But is there anything else you wanted to say or talk about in relation to that before we close up?
You know, I had two goals in publishing the book. You know, one was to help other people, right? I'm not planning on retiring on the proceeds from the book. Actually, the proceeds of the book are being donated to a charity that helps underrepresented college kids in the U.S. Land jobs, including getting them mentoring. But the other thing is, I think sometimes people are hesitant to mentor because they're not sure they're going to do it right. They're not sure they're going to say something. They're going to say something wrong. They just don't know what to do. They don't know how to find a mentee. And I would just encourage people, you know, what I learned is once I started, I was getting far more out of it than my mentees ever would. So just like you could be selfish, right? And say like, how can this help me? And also acknowledge like part of life is that we're not perfect, right? And you're going to make mistakes. And there were a lot of them in the book where I kind of didn't handle things as well. I got it wrong. And, you know, I learned from it and now other people have learned from it, right? And I think the average mentee is probably going to give you a little more grace than the typical than your own employees will. So like what a perfect place to learn and maybe make some mistakes.
Great. Well, Michelle, as I said, pleasure hooking up with you again, talking to you about this.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed reading it and talking to you. So thank you very much.
Pleasure is all mine, Michael.